This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's time for The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Coming up today, the Archdiocese of Hartford made a major announcement. We'll talk with someone who said this appointment made for not-so-happy day in Hartford. All that plus discussion about freedom of information, political fundraising, and the Boston Red Sox. I want to welcome in, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
Go Sox.
Yeah, well, we'll be talking about those Sox a little bit later on. Jeff Cohen will join us to talk about a big story that he's been covering here in the city of Hartford as well later on in the show. But we'll start here. Earlier this week, members of Connecticut's congressional delegation held a hearing about the Metro North power outage, which created a commuter nightmare for nearly 2 weeks. The presidents of Metro North and the utility company Con Edison appeared before the panel. Senator Richard Blumenthal asked Con Ed's Craig Ivey about reimbursing Metro North for the outage. Here is his response.
The MPA has already provided for refunds for customers. We, as a utility, don't believe our customers should bear the risk when a customer decides to take one of the feeders out of service, because we do know that failures can happen. In this case, it's a very improbable circumstance, but the failure did occur. But we think it unfair to ask our customers to bear the risk when a customer takes a piece of equipment out of service at their request.
Okay, that's the guy from Con Ed. So, Paz, how did Senator Blumenthal and the rest of the panel feel about that answer and some of the other answers that they heard that day?
Senator Blumenthal was channeling his days as a U.S. attorney when he actually did occasionally go into court and did cross-examine people. It was not as much as a bit of political theater as I thought it might be. I really expected these guys to be each poised over a dunking tank, and that Blumenthal and Murphy and the rest of the delegation would take turns throwing baseballs at them to see who could get them to splash in the water. But Blumenthal did press the point. He said it was your feeder line, sir. He said, well, yes, it was. Ivy is right to the extent it was the MTA's decision to take one line out of service because they were doing some maintenance, some upgrades. But Blumenthal pressed the point. He said this was a 36-year-old piece of equipment. The expected life was 30 years. And it appears that they screwed up somehow. It's a very complicated thing. This stuff is they literally have to freeze these lines because there's oil insulation. And they work in something called a freeze pit, and that freeze pit actually froze the ground outside and it froze a portion of the feeder cable that ultimately failed. So, you know, they were pointing MTA and Con Ed were pointing the fingers at each other, although it did not turn into the complete ugly free-for-all that it has certainly had the potential to.
Did we learn anything else new? I mean, I just learned more about freezer pits and feeding lines, but I mean, did we learn anything new about who's really to blame here, why this happened?
Oh, they're both to blame, and then they also turned around and pointed at all of us and said, look, the infrastructure in the Northeast Rail Corridor is really old. It needs lots and lots of stuff, not just electric hardware. There are bridges at the end of their expected lifespans. Jim Redeker, the Connecticut Transportation Commissioner, pointed out that Connecticut actually is upgrading electric service on its part. But the system is only as strong as its weakest link, and New York is not doing the similar work that Connecticut is doing. So you also have the interstate conflict. So you have conflicts with the with Metro North, Con Ed, Connecticut DOT, and New York DOT.
I feel in my comments I'm about to open myself up to voluminous emails from railroad geeks who are going to tell me that I've got it wrong, but because these are hard things to get right. But in terms of upgrading their service, I mean, and this isn't necessarily right on point for the failure that they're having hearings about right now, but as Paz suggested, the New Haven line in particular is kind of a mess. In fact, he talked about something that's 36 years old. You know what they call that on the MTA and the New Haven line? New. The New Haven line had one of the most revolutionary state-of-the-art electrical systems in the history of railroad. Unfortunately, that happened between the years 1907 and 1914, and there are parts of that system That have not been changed since 1914. They are trying to change them right now. It's what's called, and here's your word of the day, a catenary system. Catenary system is the kind of the overhead feeder lines that you'll see actually on these trains. Now, the New Haven line is unique in America because it actually has two different electrical systems. It starts out with a DC third rail system in New York. Around Pelham, you may notice a disturbance in the force as they switch over to the overhead AC catenary system. Nobody else does this. I mean, no, like maybe in India they do it or something, but nobody else does this. So right now the MTA is in the process of trying to at least upgrade that catenary system, bring it maybe somewhere close to the 21st century. There's a different kind of hanging line that's not quite as easily foulable and stuff like that. But it's amazing it works at all, and it's amazing that it doesn't fail more often because it's a very weird setup.
And if you have thoughts about the big Metro North failure of last month, who's to blame? What we should do about it? 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266, as we start our conversation there on the Wheelhouse. And Colin, it's not just about the electrical system. That was what the problem was last month. Several months before that, there was a break in the line near Bridgeport, and we heard over and over again about how the maintenance has not been done on the tracks in Connecticut the way it should. It seems as though through all of the finger pointing, we're coming to one very serious conclusion, which is this commuter rail line, which serves so many people and is an economic engine for the state, needs a massive upgrade, not just some new rail cars that we got over the course of last year to roll over it, but actually it needs to be fixed. So where are we going? Are we going to get anywhere close to this?
Well, I mean, they are doing... I mean, it depends what you mean by massive upgrade, because, I mean, probably some railroad engineers would sort of stand back from this and say, you know, you probably ought to rip out everything that you've got and start over. They're really economically probably not in a position to do that. They're doing the right thing. What they're doing is fixing the electrical system and bringing it up to grade. I don't know. I doubt that there's money to do much of anything else.
Paz, so when it comes to how, whether or not it's our congressional delegation or state lawmakers, and of course this big interstate battle back and forth in New York, are dealing with this, I mean, what are we hearing? Is this going to be something addressed, say, in this upcoming legislative session in Hartford?
No, they look to the feds for these major infrastructure pieces, because you have to remember, this is just a section in the Northeast Rail Corridor that Amtrak relies on as well. And when this thing went down, for example, Accela service, the premium service between Washington to New York to Boston, that went out. So this is an incredibly important rail corridor. It serves 1/6 of the nation's population. A big chunk of the U.S. economy is affected by it. For all of the debate about whether rail makes sense in other parts of the country where the population is a little bit more far-flung, there's really no debate that in the Northeast Corridor, rail makes perfect sense.
How did Metro North react to those comments that we heard earlier when Con Ed is saying, you know, well, essentially, it's not really our fault? Did Metro North officials have anything, you know, interesting to say in response?
It was gentle. There was pushback. They did point at each other. Con Ed made a great point of saying that it was Metro North substation that actually went out. That it was Metro North had made the decision to upgrade that substation. So that's why Con Ed had to take one of its two feeder lines out. So, there wasn't anything that was settled. There is nothing that will be settled. Ivy, the head of Con Ed, did have a point that when we talk about reimbursements, you know, when the MTA reimburses Metro North riders, it's state taxpayer money. When Con Ed reimburses, mostly it's ratepayer money, although, you know, Blumenthal did push back on that and said, well, why not shareholders? But the point is, it's not like there's these magic pots of money for the reimbursements.
And Colin, I think there's two different threads before we close this part of the conversation that I want to talk about. One is has to do with the future of rail travel in the Northeast. Now, let's just go there first as Paz talks about. Concurrent with all this, we've seen Amtrak roll out some plans over the course of the last several months and even the last year that would provide high-speed rail service through the Northeast Corridor. There is some concern about where those rails are going to go. And we look at the timelines and we see 2040 or 2050. Short of ripping everything up and starting all over again, as much as he can make a case, we can make a case, that the Northeast is the perfect place for high-speed rail service that's really technically advanced. It almost seems in some ways it's the worst place to do it. It's got all the old stuff, all the old electrical systems, all the old rails. We may never get there.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I actually was talking last night to a couple of guys who are doing long-range planning for the DOT, and I want to have a longer – they happened to be at a forum I was – at last night, and I want to have a longer conversation with them about precisely that. And I mean, the other part of this, I think for Connecticut people also, the other thing that's really interesting about this is that we clearly are going to add some more commuter rail in this state. We're going to start intermodally connecting the state. And right now, even the lines that we're talking about are complicated in other ways too. For example, the spurs that go off the New Haven line, at least two of them are diesel. So now we've got like a third technology. So at some point or other, you'd think maybe you would want to start to try to unify these technologies. But I'm already going to get, like, it's Colin, C-O-L-I-N at WNPR.org. I'm going to get so many emails from rail geeks who are going to say, I don't know what I'm talking about. And they're kind of right.
Well, let's just go away from the rail geek part of this for a second. Is one of the things that in watching this hearing that I was thinking about, as much as we've considered the impact of Superstorm Sandy last year, it's the one-year anniversary. It's actually the two-year anniversary of that big freak October snowstorm that knocked down power lines all over the state, plunged a lot of the state into the dark for 2 weeks, and we got to know very well the folks from CL&P, Northeast Utilities. They were paraded up there by Governor Malloy every single day to kind of take a beating from the press. I'm wondering, Colin, if at this point we see anything has changed with our relationship as a state and government's relationship with the utility companies. Can we indeed force them to do anything to change the way they work, to recoup money if we feel like they've done something wrong?
You know, I was talking about this this morning to Jeff Butler when he was making my latte. Actually, Paz is going to have a better answer to this than I have. I mean, as I was saying to you before the show, you know, in the term regulated monopoly, it turns out the second word is the more important word. And it is, you know, periodically, after that October snowstorm is a good example, regulators and politicians get up on their hind legs and they say, you know, we really are going to start making you guys do stuff. And that resolve will last for a while. But, these guys have a lot of oomph. They have a lot of clout. If the politicians have the will of the people behind them, which tends to be in when the people are mad about something, that impulse to regulate can last for a while. I don't know how permanent it can ever be. But you have a better finger on that pulse than I do.
All I'm thinking right now is because of another story we'll talk about later is I'm aware that Northeast Utilities is the number one donor to the Connecticut Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm not saying anything, but, you know. Yeah, I mean, when these disasters happen, there's the element of kabuki theater, right? Everybody knows their roles. In the case of the aforementioned Jeff Butler, there was the ritual sacrifice. What Starbucks is he at now?
You know? I don't like to say.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we've all seen the show before. Does anything really change? I mean, you know, it came out during those string of storms that CL&P, that some of its infrastructure was a bit old. I mean, we certainly heard it was wonderful to have all these emergency repair crews come in from Canada and the South and look at this stuff. Everybody had this experience on the street. And these guys are going, what the hell is up on that line?
We kind of are India in a lot of ways, actually.
Those changes take long-term pressure. Political systems are at their least effective when it comes to long-term attention spans.
But it gets back to that question that you say Blumenthal asked at this hearing, which is, you know, the company always says, well, that's going to impact ratepayers. And he says, well, what about shareholders? And that really sort of is at the crux of this. I mean, who ends up paying for all this stuff? Because it's going to cost money. And the government wants to protect as much as they can ratepayers. But at a certain point, companies probably going to take a haircut if they have to upgrade their infrastructure.
They do. But most of the upgrades, it comes out of ratepayer funds. I mean, that's just the way it works. There are people far more capable than me than explaining the economics of that, but that much I do know. And so when people, you know, scream about I want to see CL&P really smacked around, I want to see multi-million dollar fines, you know, you got to be careful what you wish for, because not all of it will come from the shareholders.
Let's just get one phone call in here before we move on. Jim's in Granby. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hello. Yes. Thank you for discussing this topic. You know, your point is very well taken about the political pressure being very long term. You know, rail traffic in this country has been trying to be defunded by the federal government since Reagan tried to eliminate rail traffic. But, you know, if our senators could take their eye off electric boat for 1 second, and the money from one nuclear submarine would pay for the complete refurbishment of the rail infrastructure in New England, I believe.
And it probably, and what they would say is it would cost an awful lot of jobs at Electric Boat, which is why.
I have a plan for that.
Oh, go ahead. And thank you, Jim, for your phone call. Colin's got a plan.
My plan for that is to turn an Electric Boat into an NEA-funded program. Because here's the thing. We basically need them to keep their skills up, but we don't really need them to build a submarine. So all I have to do is kind of dance and mime out building a submarine. They'll stay employed through the NEA. We won't waste all that money on raw materials for submarines, and then we can fix this guy's rail problem.
I'll be the spoil sport and point out that it's never that simple. It's always easy to look at one pot of money and say it should be over here, but that's not how federal funding works. The busway, we hear that argument over and over again. Why don't we take that money and spend it here? Well, it's very complicated to explain how exactly, but it's not possible.
It's called CT Fast Track.
You are right. I apologize.
Because we will get calls about that as well. Hey, let's move on quickly because before we take a break,
even though there's no track, by the way.
I want to talk a little bit about Democratic fundraising. Governor Malloy makes a trip out to California. He's raising big money for the Democratic Party. How big is this money? Is he making it rain?
Well, you know, you cannot precisely tie dollars to his presence, but what you can say is he is taking the lead. He is the rainmaker. And I looked at what the Democrats have done in the first 9 months of this year compared to first 9 months 4 years ago when they were gearing up for the last gubernatorial election. And guess what? They're doing triple what they did 4 years ago. Without an incumbent governor to lead the charge, they were raising about $500,000. They're up over $1.5 million. And, oh, by the way, the Republicans are exactly where they were 4 years ago, although technically, actually, they're $6,000 less than they were 4 years ago. So clearly, having an incumbent governor is making a huge, huge difference. And if you look at who the donors are, we are getting back to a pay-to-play system of people who have an interest in government ponying up big, big dollars. There's a big loophole in funding. The state of Connecticut banned state contractors from giving to state committees and state campaigns. But the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they raise most of their money through their federal account, which can handle all the overhead, and there are no such restrictions there.
You know, my reaction, first of all, reading Paz's article, this was reinforced, but on one of the last bleary nights of the session, in the kinds of hallway encounters that make up a huge part of Paz's life, at some strange hour, I ran into Luke Bronin, who's part of the governor's inner circle. Very smart guy, very nice guy, guy I like a lot. But he said, you know, he really wanted me to look at, you know, what they'd done with the campaign finance laws and the change. He goes, I think you won't be as bothered by it as you expect because blah, 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 blah. I don't remember. You know, it's 2 a.m. You'd believe anything. And then I looked. And it's not even one law, as Paz can tell you. It's like this hideous kind of find and replace thing where they just changed all kinds of things. But basically, I was looking and I went, oh, no, dude, you broke it. You broke our campaign finance system. And the coverage now shows that. I mean, Mark is absolutely right. We're not getting back to the old system. We're back there. You know, this is what's happened. The kinds of reforms. I mean, we still have a public financing system, but the kind of third-party expenditures that you're going to see this time around indicate really that the old game, if it ever really went away, is fully back in place. What they did in the past session is break campaign financing to a substantial degree, to expand those limits so that money can just flood in, particularly to the individual state parties. So, I mean, I think that's that.
The state parties this year will be able to make unlimited expenditures in support of their candidates. That's probably the biggest change. The other one is the contribution limits to the state parties to their state accounts was $5,000. Now it's $10,000, which is what it is to the federal account. But I mean, I want to be clear. When I say pay to play, I am not claiming that this administration or any other is selling quid pro quos. It's the perception that if you have business that you pony up, For example, the gentleman owns the Philadelphia Flyers, also owns Spectacor, which manages the XL Center in Hartford and Rensselaer Field. Well, he wrote a $10,000 check to the Democrats this year. Now, would he have been so inclined? You know, I don't know. I tend to doubt it. But the Democratic Party this time, they raised well over $400,000 of their total funding in increments of $10,000.
I think the other thing is it makes oversight by the press or Common Cause or anybody else really hard. So, you know, you have something weird that happens, like we suddenly get Keno in the budget. And so then hardworking reporters like Paz and John Linder think, well, I wonder how much money Scientific Games, which makes Keno machines, has pumped into the Connecticut political system. Well, it's really hard to figure that out because you have to look a lot of places. You have to look at leadership PACs. You have to look at these state party contributions. You have to figure out who these individual donors are. Do they have some connection to Company X? It's really hard to figure out how much influence any individual company is having on the political system. The answer is quite frequently a lot, but harder to document with all this, with the sort of piecemeal nature of it now.
And you have this fundamental contradiction or tension because we also have public financing. Our governor was elected with public financing in maximum donations of $100. So on the one hand, he lives in that world, and on the other hand, he's on these trips where people can write checks for 10 grand.
Coming up a bit later on the program, we're going to be talking a bit more about secrecy, the inability for hardworking reporters, as Colin called them, to find information that we need and freedom of information. That's coming up later on in the program. We're talking with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, an announcement from the Archdiocese of Hartford, a new archbishop. We'll be talking with Michael Sean Winters, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. We'll continue in the Wheelhouse, coming up right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's time for The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us in studio, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Before we move on, I should say that Where We Live is honored to be given an award tonight by the Connecticut Alliance for Basic Human Needs. They're holding their annual awards dinner tonight at the old Brazza Restaurant on Farmington Avenue in Hartford. There's more information about the event on the Where We Live Facebook page, and I hope that you can join us. I know, Colin, you hosted an interesting event last night that we were talking about a bit in the newsroom. What was this thing?
It was, I think its identity is hashtag Young Hartford. It was put on by the Hartford Current and Fox and HYPE, which is a young professionals group in Hartford and the Old State House. And they had a really big crowd there. There was a sort of a conversation about how you keep people in their 20s and early 30s in Hartford, how you make Hartford meaningful to them. I don't think we would necessarily solve anything, but I was amazed once again at the human capital available. There's still a lot more people than you could have gotten for an event like this one even 10 or 15 years ago.
And if you want to read more about this, check out Colin's column in the Hartford Current this past weekend on this subject. Now, yesterday, the Archdiocese of Hartford announced a new archbishop. Leonard Blair comes to Hartford from Toledo, where he is currently bishop. Here to talk with us about Bishop Blair and his appointment is Michael Sean Winters, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's the author of Left at the Altar, How the Democrats Lost the Catholics. Michael Sean, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be with you.
So you say that yesterday was not a happy day for Hartford. Why do you say that?
Well, I was hoping, I think many of us were hoping that this was one of Pope Francis's first major appointments and that it would reflect the kind of new style, more pastoral style of the Pope, which has been so electrifying for the world. And sadly, it doesn't seem to suggest that. Bishop Blair is more in the style of the kind of American culture warrior bishop. I said to a friend up there in Connecticut, he will put the arch into archbishop. And so I think it was a missed opportunity for the Vatican to put in someone who may have had more experience, you know, working with the poor, being out among the people. Bishop Blair's resume has a long stint serving in the Vatican, which is, well, that's not a place where you really get the smell of the sheep, as the Pope said he wanted his bishops to have.
One of the things that we have heard about on NPR when it comes to Bishop Blair is some of his differences with a leadership conference of women religious. Maybe you can explain what that group is and what the differences Bishop Blair has had with that group.
Yes, this is the Leadership Conference of Women Religious was established in the 1950s under the auspices of the Holy See, and it brings together different women's religious orders, and they have certain meetings, and they help each other do best practices and things like this. So it's kind of a professional organization for nuns. And Bishop Blair conducted what's called a doctrinal investigation that was really unfair. And it, you know, I mean, I have no sympathy with some of the theology he criticized that the speakers at these LCWR conferences have. But, you know, the fact of the matter is 51 weeks of the year, these women religious are out serving the poor, healing the sick, teaching the young. And if one weekend of the year they get together and they listen to some goofy lectures, I don't think that's the end of the world. Unfortunately, this was very harsh. It provoked an overseer of the LCWR. Bishop Blair is actually a member of one of the three bishops who are doing that oversight. But, for instance, he criticized, there's a group called Network, and they do lobbying on behalf of the poor here in Washington. And he criticized them for not paying attention to abortion and same-sex marriage. Well, they concentrate on poverty, not on abortion and same-sex marriage, and the church has to multitask. But, of course, this was criticism came out before Pope Francis famously said that the church should not be obsessed with the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage in the public square. So, I think we were kind of hoping for a pope who would, for a new archbishop who would be a little bit more sympathetic with and familiar with the work that the church does for the poor, and understand, yeah, sometimes you get into some messy situations. You know, Pope Francis has said, don't be afraid of making mistakes. When you look at Bishop Blair's history, it is someone who is very fearful of making mistakes, and I think that sometimes cripples our efforts to get out and be with the poor.
We heard from him last year on Terry Gross and Fresh Air, talking about the issues in his report on the LCWR, and one of the things that they talked about was homosexuality. Let's listen to a little bit of that interview with Terry Gross and Bishop Blair.
The doctrinal assessment also criticizes the Leadership Conference of Women Religious by saying that issues of crucial importance to the life of the church and society, such as the church's biblical view of family life and human sexuality, are not part of the LCWR agenda in a way that promotes the church's teachings. What would you like to see the group teaching about human sexuality?
Well, I think another great issue of our society today is the defense of the God-given institution of marriage between one man and one woman. And I think everybody knows this is at the front line of moral issues in our country today. And so what we would imagine happening for a organization of Catholic religious women would be that they would be front and center in speaking on behalf of this fundamental teaching. And yet we don't find that.
This idea that Bishop Blair is assuming that this is front and center in the line of moral issues in our country, it really speaks to what you've just been talking about here, Michael Shawn. It seems in almost direct contrast to what we've been hearing coming out of the Vatican since the new pope took over.
Well, it's certainly not who am I to judge, is it? I think what the Pope famously said when asked about a gay priest, actually. And I think there is, undoubtedly, this is a big burning issue. The church has a very different stance on same-sex marriage from the ambient culture. But there's no recognition, and I've not failed to see this in the man's career. You know, we lost what the Catholic Church means by marriage, one man and one woman forever. That went out with no-fault divorce laws in the 70s. It went out in the 50s when the divorce rates started to go up, even among Catholics. There's no recognition that this difference between what the culture views marriage and what the church views as marriage has been going on for a long time. It's become this just kind of, blame the gays and bash them, and it's a civilizational threat. And no concern, actually, for gays and lesbians who understandably worry about being excluded from society. And the way that exclusion can lead to condemnation and can lead to, discrimination. So, unfortunately, I don't think he will be very adept at articulating the church's teaching in a way that's persuasive.
Colin?
Yeah, Michael Shawn, it's Colin. First of all, in defense of Bishop Blair, he's been in Toledo. He may have had some dealings with Klinger, and that could have knocked anybody for a loop. But, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about the sort of the profile of the Archbishop here in Hartford. We're coming off Archbishop Mansell, who's the incumbent Archbishop. An interesting guy in certain ways. He has a photographic memory, which he likes to show off. He can walk into a room of 25 people, and an hour later, he can spit back their names. But not a guy who's a real firebrand in either way. He's not, I don't think, I mean, Michael Shaun might disagree, but I don't see him ultimately as a firebrand for socially conservative causes or for social and economic justice the way that some bishops have been. That's kind of been the style here in Hartford. I mean, I don't think Archbishop Cronin, we've only had four archbishops, and Archbishop Cronin, I don't think he's sort of known one way or another outside of Hartford. The best hope, I mean, most of the news from a certain point of view seems kind of bad, and Michael Shaun's article was very depressing. But the hope might be that at least he might get back to the style of Archbishop Whalen. Now, Archbishop Whalen was probably the last archbishop that everybody in Connecticut knew, and that's because the numbers were bigger back then. There were just a lot more Catholics in the state of Connecticut. The Catholic Church was much more interwoven with the political process, too, and they really had much more of a presence at the Capitol, a discernible presence at the Capitol. But Archbishop Whalen, although he was a very conservative guy, he led this very austere lifestyle and kind of led by example in some ways, and he's probably closer to some of the things that Pope Francis is trying to set up than a lot of bishops that I could think of, and including the two most recent ones. So maybe there's that. But it seems as though Hartford isn't a place so far where the church puts somebody who has a really prophetic thing to say. And Michael Shaun, I know that you were quite enchanted with the Honduran Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga, who gave this very prophetic speech about the future of bishops, of the future of the church. This is a few days ago. He said the hierarchy has no purpose in itself and for itself, but only in reference and subordination to the community. Only from the perspective of someone crucified by the powers of this world is it possible to explain the authority of the church. So, Michael Shaun, there's that strain that's going on right now under Pope Francis, but I don't think there's a whole other strain, and I think that's the one we're getting in Hartford.
Right. Well, you do have an example very near to Hartford up in Boston of someone who was a Pope Francis bishop before we had Pope Francis, and that's Cardinal Shaun O'Malley, who lives a very simple life, came in, sold the house, moved into a very small room at the rectory at the cathedral. You go there for lunch and you get a tuna fish salad sandwich, very unfussy, very out with the people, very goes to the prisons, goes to the homeless shelters. So that style has been out there. And I don't want to use this word style as kind of like, something arbitrary here. It's a way of being in the world that we in the Catholic Church call apostolic. It is imitating Christ. And sadly, some of our bishops in America are from that school, which, out goes the hand so you can kiss the ring, and they get all dressed up with all the fal de ral, and they consider themselves, kind of princes of the church. And I think the Pope is calling us to get away from that. I'm not familiar with Archbishop designate Blair's, personal lifestyle, but he does not come across as somebody who has the smell of the sheep, to go back to that phrase that the Pope used. What he wants in his bishops is someone with the smell of the sheep.
Michael Shaun Winters writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's the author of Left at the Altar, How the Democrats Lost the Catholics. Michael Shaun, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
And if you want to read more about this story, you can find stories on our website, WNPR.org. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about another sort of religion here in New England. Yes, it's the Boston Red Sox. They may very well win their third World Series in just the last decade or so tonight. Or, again, they may not. Mark Pasniuk has tickets to the game, and we'll be talking more about that with him and with Colin McEnroe. We'll also be talking about freedom of information. It seems like secrecy is all the rage in the news these days. Jeff Cohen joins us as well here on The Wheelhouse and Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's Halloween. What are your kids eating? We'll be talking about childhood obesity. Over the summer, we saw the first signs of a national decline in obesity rates among low-income children. Also, researchers in the UK have found a gene that appears to be responsible for an increase in appetite. We'll be talking with a variety of folks, including scholars at the Rudd Center down at Yale University. So join us on tomorrow's conversation here on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We've been talking with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's in your show this afternoon, Colin?
We're talking about is work the best place to work in a time when obviously we can work almost anywhere a lot of the time. Is it still good to go into a sort of a physical place where you're all together? And if so, what kind of physical place would be the best place to be?
Ooh, this sounds interesting. That's this afternoon at 1 on the Colin McEnroe Show. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, who has a cozy office at the state capitol. And Jeff Cohen joins us. He's a reporter for WNPR who covers a variety of things, including the city of Hartford. Hi, Jeff.
Morning.
So you've been covering a story about dealings at Hartford City Hall for the last couple weeks, and it surrounds a guy named Earl O'Garrow and a guy named Adam Cloud. Maybe you just take us through this story and where we are right now.
Wow, yeah. It's not the easiest story to explain, so let's just do it slowly. There, essentially, a report came from the Hartford Public Schools, which shares insurance coverage with the city, that they were concerned that there was a conflict of interest between the city treasurer, Adam Cloud, and a man named Earl O'Garrow and his insurance business. The allegation, at least, was that Cloud was steering business, city insurance business, to this insurance broker, who at the same time was renting office space from Adam Cloud's family and was also hiring Adam Cloud's brother to be his lobbyist at the state capitol. So that's the what are we talking about? The reason we're talking about it is because the insurance broker failed to pay about $670,000 in insurance premiums for the city of Hartford. It's important to note that the city never lost its coverage because of a state law that says you can't lose your coverage if you've paid your broker, essentially. But the money is essentially gone, as is a lot of money, apparently, according to the state insurance department, that he was supposed to pay for other people's insurance.
And when you started looking into Earl O'Garrow, you found that there was actually a lot of money that he'd been borrowing over the course of time at around the same time this money went missing.
That's right. At the same time he wasn't paying the city of Hartford's insurance premiums, he was over-mortgaging or really heavily mortgaging a home that he owns in Marlboro, taking out about $800,000 in loans on a house that he bought for $539,000 just a couple of years ago.
Now, Adam Cloud, the city treasurer, denies any sort of connection to this, involvement in this, but the story kind of ramped up within the last few days because now there's a federal investigation.
That's right. And what's interesting, you know, as I've covered the city for a little while, and there were stories for a couple of years about Eddie Perez, the former mayor of the city of Hartford, before there was any real action from law enforcement for 2 years, right? Now here it's 2 weeks into this story, and we've got on last Thursday federal subpoenas were served on City Hall, essentially confirming that there's a grand jury investigation looking into this very matter.
So what's in these subpoenas?
Good question. We don't know, and that's a softball, but
so Jeff, what do we know? Nothing.
We don't. Yes. We don't know what the feds are looking for, and that is a bone of contention between those of us who think that grand jury subpoenas should be public. Grand juries themselves, federal grand juries, are protected by lots of secrecy rules in the rules of federal criminal procedure. The subpoenas are not protected. Anyone who has a subpoena from the federal government actually has a right to say, I've been subpoenaed. It's something they should be able to talk about if they want to. It might not be in their interest, but they can. Well, in the city's case, the minute it is served, a subpoena is served upon the city, it becomes a public document. And we're still waiting on the city. The city has been gracious and has initially declined our request for the subpoena and now has said it's thinking about it.
Have you talked to the mayor about them? Have you asked the mayor essentially why the city has kept this information from you?
We did. We asked him on Thursday, and here's what he said.
I understand and I value and I respect the public's right to know with respect to any of this information. But at the same time, I want to honor and comply with the U.S. Attorney's Office request that we, as they continue any investigation, not comment upon the matter.
Do they make a request that you not share the subpoenas themselves?
No. Actually, we are free to share the subpoena that was received by the city with respect to the particular items that might have been requested in order not to compromise the investigation. I don't think that we are at liberty to share that, and I want to be fully cooperative given the importance of this matter with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
So what you're seeing, John, is deference to the federal investigators. Now, one could say one should be appropriately deferential to U.S. attorneys when they ask you to do certain things because they have a lot of power and power that could make you scared. We get that. But we also think you, as reporters, our bias is towards deferring towards the public, deferring towards public information. And as you and I have spoken before, we're seeing a lot of deference when it comes to freedom of information to people or interests other than the public. And that's becoming something that we're seeing a lot of lately.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to broaden the conversation out to, because it seems, Colin, as though a number of the stories Jeff's covering, and we can refer to a few more, we seem to keep coming back to the freedom of information of this information is the story more than the underlying story. People seem to want to keep things under wraps just within the last few weeks, months, more than we've seen in some time.
Yeah, I mean, I served on a League of Women Voters panel about this a few days ago, and it clearly is a trend at the city level, at the state level, and certainly at the federal level. I mean, the answer seems to be none of your damn business when we ask a lot of basic questions about the functioning of government. I would say that I feel like the work that Jeff has done is important enough so that I would hate to see the FOI issue obscure a lot of things that are really wrong in city government. I mean, I think it is. I mean, over the last few days, for very good reasons, we've bogged down a little bit on the whole question of the subpoena. Who are we going to get it? What's the FOI fight going to be about? Underlying that is a lot of reporting that Jeff has done about the relationship between Cloud and Ogero, which raises gigantic questions about how the city operates. You know, I keep making a little list that I call things that are wrong. Another thing that is wrong, as far as I'm concerned, is that Adam Cloud's wife also works in a very key job here. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff. I believe the check actually was sent by her. She works in the finance department of the city.
She is overseen. This is complicated now. She is overseen by the finance department. She actually works in the treasurer's office. So Adam at one point oversaw his wife. And this is an ongoing matter.
And when you say the check that went to Earl Ogero, $670,000
that we don't have,
that is now missing. That check got sent. Mark?
The FOI issue becomes the issue everybody grabs because it's easy. And it's a yes or no. Mayor, are you going to give us the documents? You know, Mr. Cloud, are you going to give us the documents? What Jeff's reporting is doing is very complicated. It involves nuance, relationships, stuff that may be a violation of law, or stuff that simply may be in that awful gray area that is wrong but is perhaps not illegal.
That's right. I mean, to flesh out Adam Cloud to the treasurer's defense, one, he said, look, I had nothing to do with it. Well, we have since found emails that suggest that he had at least something to do with it. We've written those stories, and they're at WNPR.org. But also, you know, let's say he wanted to help a new minority business in the city succeed. And we've heard this before. Is that so wrong? Well, I mean, so that's sort of the defense that we hear. Mm-hmm. So then Colin, you were going to say.
Well, the question that emerges as I read and listen to your stuff, too, is that's absolutely the case. One scenario is he kind of went outside the usual network for this kind of stuff. In other words, as Jeff has discovered, there are bigger companies that typically handle this kind of stuff. This is a smaller minority-owned company, so from that perspective, this looks like maybe kind of a good thing. Then the next question is, well, how well did Cloud know Ogero, the guy who ran this thing? Well, Jeff's reporting suggests they knew each other pretty well. I mean, they really spent some time in each other's company. And at a certain point, you kind of hope that you look at the things that you know about a person, and maybe some flags go up. It's like watching that Tate George video for the reality show. It's like, oh, if I watch that video, I don't think I would be investing my money with Tate George. And, you know, it's at a certain point you kind of hope that Adam Cloud's knowledge about this guy adds up to something other than, yeah, let's do business with him.
I think a blind spot that there is Adam doesn't see a problem with certain things. And this has come up repeatedly. He doesn't see it as that it could be perceived as a problem that he oversees his wife or oversaw his wife and now she works with him. And that's caused him continual problems.
Paz, one of the things I wanted to tie into all this is the conversation we've had a few times on this program about how information flows up. And again, we've seen this in the last couple of weeks. Still no official word on the Sandy Hook shootings from the state police, but we keep getting little bits of information leaked out over time. This is one of the failures, I think, from the press standpoint, when we're not able to get all the information we need in order to tell a story. We're sort of at the mercy of leakers, people who are trying to dribble out information slowly over time. And it's really having an impact, I think, in this story, in this case.
It does, because the hunt for the information becomes part of the story that may overshadow at times the substance. So instead of putting this stuff out in a logical, sensible way, we get these bits and pieces, sometimes leaked by people who I think are well-intended, who simply want to get the information out, sometimes leaked by people who want a piece of the story out. And then it's only months later when you see all the pictures of the puzzle that you see how different people performed. You know, this obviously is the most sensitive, issue when it comes to FOI. Every time this stuff comes out, you have families down in Newtown who are hit hard by it. You would think they could get to the point where they could do, even if it was an interim report, but have a detailed interim report about what they know at this point.
And Paz, transparency is good politics for the most part. And just to circle back to one of your stories that we talked about earlier, one of the problems for Malloy's California trip was they were unforthcoming about it originally. In some ways, if you're going to do something like this, you should say, here, we're going to California, here's who we're meeting with, and, whatever, make whatever you want out of it. If you turn it into this thing where you and Lender and people like that have to go hunting around and finding stuff.
Look, it's like running away from a dog. The dog will chase you. But you're 100% right, because now you have these little stories about his California trip. Did he meet with a state contractor? Well, guess what? That's legal. And not only could he have met with a state contractor, he could have accepted a $10,000 check from a state contractor. And so if they had just put out where they were, who they talked to, it's a different story.
Look, and here's the thing. There's a lot to talk about. We've got 2 minutes left in the show, and we haven't even mentioned the Red Sox yet, Paz. And so we have to do this. You're going to the game tonight. What's been your big takeaway from the series so far?
Surprisingly little enjoyment, because these games have been so goddamn tense. I mean, really. And, I would count myself a fairly reasonable Red Sox fan. I've been going to Fenway Park since I was 9 years old. The first game I saw was, the ninth play. Yes, young listeners, listen. The ninth place Red Sox play the 10th place Yankees.
Yeah.
These things have been gut-wrenching.
They've been gut-wrenching, and they've been going so late, Colin. It's almost impossible to have a normal life and watch baseball.
Yeah, the Boston Globe did this really interesting graphic about sort of how much sleep you would lose if you went to bed 45 minutes after the game ends, after the Uehara pickoff, and calm down, you go to bed. And then depending on what time you get up, how much sleep you got and how much you lost compared to what you would have ordinarily gotten. I'm unfortunately so tired that I could not understand the graphic.
And look, one thing we just have to mention, it may not end up mattering. If the Red Sox come back and win this game tonight, or they win tomorrow night, they will win the series. And what happened on Saturday night won't really matter. But this now infamous call, this obstruction call at third base, I thought it pointed out some of the most important things about Red Sox Nation, which is it's a nation made up of people who are interesting, smart, fact-based people who for some reason couldn't see the most obvious thing in the world, that the umpire made the right call.
Shut up.
I was seeing tweets from people all over Red Sox Nation, professors at Harvard University, who were just wrong about this, Paz. Am I missing something
No,
here?
You're not missing something. And Twitter during a Red Sox game is just a whole nother thing, because it puts you in the biggest bar in the world and everyone's screaming. And some people are right and some people are wrong. But I agree with you. That was obstruction. I think it's a dumb rule, because if you dive for the ball and you're flat in the ground, but we don't need to get into that.
Well, and just before we end, though, with Jeff Cohen in the room, his Saints famously won a Super Bowl after Katrina, and it really helped to rally the city. Do you think it means something, the Red Sox having the season they've had after the Boston Marathon bombings? Just a short answer.
You're talking to somebody who's been rolling his eyes to a degree standing in Fenway when all these people are trotted out. I get very uncomfortable with it. Some of it's very nice. So, yes, there will be a little lift, but let's not overplay that.
Colin?
I'm sort of with Paz on this. The Boston Strong thing may be a little bit overplayed. I just do want to quickly say it. Bill Buckner must be so happy that they didn't have GIFs or GIFs or whatever, however we're going to pronounce that, in his day, because poor Will Middlebrooks is going to live in one for the rest of hell.
And people, stop telling my wife how much I could sell these tickets for tonight. It's not helping.
Good luck, Paz. Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, and Jeff Cohen from WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live.